Great. Good afternoon. We're glad to see you in our last afternoon of our seminar series. So today is a very important topic, learning to trust and to love. We have been praying for this time, praying for you, that God may open our minds to learn and our attitudes and any curiosity within ourselves to really delve into the knowledge that's out there for us. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge two individuals present here with us that supported us very, very selfishly, I would say. Unselfishly, that is. Yes, thank you. And that is, I'm talking about my father-in-law and mother-in-law, Jean and Donna. Do you want to stand up for us? They have bought our books, the books that we have been passing around, Ministry of Healing. So let's give them a hand. Thank you, thank you. Their love is just overflowing, and they, like I said, unselfishly have supported us this week. We're very grateful to have you. Okay, let's start. Let's begin, shall we? You can tell I'm very excited to be here this afternoon. Okay, learning to trust and to love in the context of our brain, the health of our brains. Why connect what we put in our stomachs with our ability to trust and to love? Why shall we do that, or must we do it? Well, there's a quote by Ellen G. White in Ministry of Healing, chapter 23. You can look in your books on your own time and read the whole chapter. This is a quote from that chapter. The stomach is closely related to the brain, and when the stomach is diseased, the nerve power is called from the brain to aid of the weakened digestive organs. When these demands are too frequent, the brain becomes congested. Wow, there it is. There it is, the connection between the brain and the gut. Now, you fast forward about a century and more, and we got to the amazing body of research talking about the gut and the brain. The gut and the brain are connected in both health and disease. As a matter of fact, they're so important, both the communication of these two organs, these two tissues or organs, systems, they're important in maintaining health for us. How do they do it? So here we're looking at the lining, the epithelial lining of the gut. All these cells neatly arranged in a layer. Here we have the brain, and these are the pathways by which the gut communicates with the brain. This communication exists via the vagus nerve, one way from the gut to the brain, then back using the adrenergic system, that is the sympathetic chain of the autonomic nervous system. We have also the communication via neurotransmitters, and also metabolites and cytokines produced by the immune system. What happens is and I shall not forget that in the cavity, the lumen of the gut, that is the hollow space there, that is basically inhabited by, I think it's a trillions and quadrillions. What I know is that there are much more microorganisms there in our guts than we have cells. Did you know that? That is a remarkable amount of microorganisms and bacteria known as microbiota that reside in our GI system. As a matter of fact, we're basically the biggest colony they find. And you multiply that times many animals, you imagine the amount of microorganisms that we house in our guts. But they, as we have explained before, have a great function for us, and we'll explain those a little bit, but I like to summarize this. They do it by three ways. The gut microbes can produce neurotransmitters. These neurotransmitters might signal the brain via the vagus nerve here in pink. So the vagus nerve conducts these neurotransmitters back to the brain, that is, from the gut. The gut microbes can also stimulate immune cells to produce cytokines. And this happens when the gut becomes leaky. See, notice this space right here where the pointer is. There's one bacterium trying to make his way inside the interstitial fluid and the blood vessels, the bloodstream. So guess what? That will activate the immune system. So the immune system will release cytokines, and those cytokines will signal the brain to adjust to mood and well-being and the you know, how we feel, basically. Those things have been documented. There's a third mechanism of this bidirectional communication between these two organs. The gut microbes can produce metabolites. These metabolites are precursors of neurotransmitters. They can also travel via the vagus nerve and also through the bloodstream and affect the brain so that the brain reacts in ways that we feel it. Our whole being feels that there's something wrong where? In the gut. Have you felt that way? When you get sick, that's exactly what's happening. Now, when we talk about this communication, we obviously talk about food intake, and food intake is regulated by various areas of the brain, not just one area of the brain, but multiple areas. So among those, I'd like to mention just a few, the main ones here. The prefrontal area is where the integration of sensory information takes place, and is this area in blue where I'm pointing. It exerts inhibitory control of eating so that when you are satiated, you had enough to eat, enough calorie intake, the prefrontal cortex signals via the hypothalamus, and both in communication, concerted communication, and tell you enough is enough, is stop eating. A lot of people get this area dysregulated and do not have a break. They continue to ingest. And this obeys to several inputs that we'll touch briefly for the lack of time in our subsequent slides. We also have the hippocampus, because the hippocampus forms memories of our foods. How many of you remember what you ate when you were a child and you enjoyed it so much from mom? Don't we? So those memories are seared and established, well established in our hippocampus, so that we gravitate towards those foods. Now, I'm not here asking you whether those foods were good or bad, but that those memories are there. It's in storage. And storage for us to go back to. The fusiform gyrus, this area right below the hippocampus, but it's in the ventral and the temporal lobe of the brain. That's where object recognition, including food, takes place, that process. And there are many signaling pathways to the ventral tegmental area of the center of reward. So what happens here in this region is we are able to distinguish just by looking at them, the texture and the flavors, the odors, whether that food is good or bad for us. And this is based on familiarity. So if we're familiar with one type of food, we'll tend to gravitate towards that food. If we are kind of aversive because we don't know, how many of you have gone to a restaurant overseas or in any other town and something was different about that food and you go, I think I'm going to pass. I'm going to go to a different food that I'm more familiar with. That is the activation of this area. And the hypothalamus, as I explained, regulates the energy state and the whole body. And so all these factors are at play during food intake. Now you're learning quite a bit, aren't you? So that is our hope, that every time you think about what happens when you ingest a food, different areas of the brain are being activated. And before I move on, I'd like to tell you that the energy from food is so important for brain processes that the brain gets direct input from the gut. So this is the representation of one of the microvilli in our gut, a fold. Here are the cells. So they get the brain here, gets that input from the gut and relays that information to the liver. So that information directly to the liver is what is known as the gut-brain liver axis. This communication is so important for us that is crucial. If any of these organs is damaged, there's a problem when we ingest foods. Now, we have been talking about food yesterday for the last 3 days, basically since we began, right? I'd like to bring your attention to the control of food intake today, because that has to do with a spiritual component as well. So I'd like to share with you the following quotes. This is for Ministry of Healing, page 307.3. Less food should be eaten on the Sabbath in order that the mind may be clear and vigorous to comprehend spiritual things. Amen? A clogged stomach means a clogged brain. Many do more than they think to unfit their minds for receiving the benefits of its sacred opportunities. This was written by Ellen G. White more than a century ago. Think about that. A lot of times we enjoy these foods during what times? Sabbath, exactly. And I was talking this morning with my dear brethren over there in the youth chapel that we love these foods because we have an emotional attachment and a spiritual connection, right? Because this food was prepared with a lot of love and care by our brethren who love us so much, and they want to share with us. They said, please taste my food. This potato is excellent. This is what my grandma used to make, and you know, I perfected the recipe and so forth. And maybe a nice vegan plate there and dish or fruits here, then salads, and we want it all. That's our tendency. But we must remember to be a little temperate. How can we do this? And I made a recommendation that always put aside a little bit of in a container and take it with you and savor it throughout the weekend. There's nothing wrong with that. But Ellen G. White, in her time, ahead of her time, recommended that we should take it easy on foods on Sabbath. So I thought I brought this for us to kind of be mindful of what she wrote back in those days. I have a second quote for the same book, Ministry of Healing. This is in 301.1 in the section, and it says, many writers and speakers after eating heartily give themselves to sedentary occupations, reading, studying, or writing, allowing no time for physical exercise. As a consequence, they cannot write or speak with the force and intensity necessary in order to reach the heart. Their efforts are tame and fruitless. Think about this. So next time you want to have a heart meal, you know, you can always have this in the back of the mind. I thought this was an interesting message for us to share. And so we wanted to share it with you. Now, let's delve a little bit on the calorie intake, because whenever we talk about food consumption, we have to think about calorie intake.
So we'll just give you a few statistics on calories. So this graph starts around 1960, and it's measuring world calorie consumption per person. And we can see the United States has kind of run to the top by 2010. So we're eating plenty of calories. And industrialized countries have closely tied meetings and occasions, work events, celebrations, holidays are tied to food. So what we want to try to do, and I'll read that to you, sorry, it's not big enough. We want to try to not eat when we are not hungry, because this is will lead to having more byproducts. Basically, don't eat when you're not hungry, and do eat when you are hungry. But regularity, I'm a little loud. Regularity in eating patterns is also good, to have regular times for eating. Cognitive function, this is research done by Gomez Pinilla at UCLA. I found his research probably 5 years ago, maybe even more now.
More than that.
But he's done a lot with cognition and how food affects that. If you look into his research, I said, is he a Seventh-day Adventist or something? He must be reading Ellen White and doing his research. But he was looking at diet and exercise, the effects on the mitochondria. The mitochondria here is the powerhouse of the cell. It makes all the energy. It's like the power, you know, the power company. And depending on what you're eating, then, as we learned this week, it affects the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and then synaptic plasticity, which you want more of. So if you're eating too much or the wrong kinds of foods, his research looked at fruits and vegetables, a lot of different compounds in fruits and vegetables, and how they improve synaptic plasticity. And also making epigenetic changes to the DNA and how food and exercise change that and then result in how you're thinking. When you are getting dysregulated in your eating, that can lead to loss of homeostasis. You want loss of energy balance. So you're getting too much energy in, not enough energy out, and that's kind of disrupting the system. So excess calories can reduce synaptic plasticity. That's one of the findings of his research. And they increase vulnerability. That state increases vulnerability to cell damage and causes free radical formation. And it surpasses the body's capacity to buffer that process happening. What Ellen White said many years ago has been confirmed by extensive research, which has showed that during increased caloric intake, cellular mechanisms to clean the metabolites and byproducts away must be activated at the expense of important cognitive function. This is a summary of what Dr. Gomez-Pinilla found. So it's almost like he was reading Ellen White and finding the results there in his research. It's really amazing. If you have a chance, look up Gomez-Pinilla. Both calorie restriction, and his work is in mice and rodents, so both calorie restriction and reduced meal frequency, intermittent fasting, suppress the development of various diseases and increase the production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is going to increase your cognitive function. Appetite for certain foods is strongly influenced by thoughts. So yesterday we talked about thoughts, feelings, behaviors. Oh, sorry, I didn't talk about that yesterday. But thoughts, feelings, behaviors are connected. And they're strongly connected. And what you choose for your food is strongly connected to your thoughts. And also, there can be emotions around guilt, shame, anger, resentment. Sometimes people use food to treat negative feelings like fears of rejection, beliefs about being inferior, unworthiness. Also, there could be problems with malnutrition and spiritual components to your appetite. So all of these things can affect how much someone is eating and what their food choices are. So we always want to be kind and try to understand where someone else is coming from. It's very easy to look at somebody on the outside and see certain things and not realize what their struggles are on the inside. So we want to consider that before we make too many assumptions about them. Can we put aside trust and love by what we eat?
So we ask this question, and as we look at this picture, what do we see? We see an angry animal, right? We don't dare get near him. Well, if we think about it, he's got this bowl, well labeled, by the way. And in that bowl, he doesn't have much, does he? But boy, the amount that he has there packs a lot of calories that will satisfy him, so he would not stop at anything if you come near his face. Do we have some of that attitude sometimes for our foods? Do we hold on to those, basically? Well, these have a more intrinsic component than just hunger, let me tell you. So let me tell you, and let me integrate this into the fear circuit of our brain, because that's how we've been talking about this, approaching it from that perspective. And so let me ask the type of food, or let me assert to you that the type of food does affect our mood and behavior. Let me repeat that again. The type of food or foods, a food does affect our mood and behavior. And this has been found in the literature. And let me just rephrase to you what's going on. This is the limbic system, the emotional component of our brain. The limbic system is associated with emotions such as fear, as we know now, and aggression, right? But it also drives emotions produced by food and sex, other pleasurable activities innate in every mammal, every animal, and human beings. Also, predatory aggression for food and affective aggression to scare other animals are mediated by this same center, the hypothalamus especially. The midbrain and amygdala are all activated during this process in lots of sympathetic activity. That means lots of adrenaline flowing through our system. So, in order to scare off animals use this system to say, this is mine, and to really grab on to what they have. Have you seen in the documentaries a cheetah hunting down a prey? It's such ferocity because it knows that if it doesn't do it right at that moment, what's going to happen? There's no more chances. Let me ask you, do we act in a similar way when we are around food? That's the question I want to bring to you. Some may do. Look at this gentleman. He says, you better give me what I order for, right? And also we have the kids. Kids are, they're craving their sugar high, and they're like, give me that what I need. Well, let me tell you, there was a study done in British children ages 5 to 9. They were split into two groups. Group one received healthy options. And they were all gathered around this party, by the way. So they both attended a party. But one group was allowed to have, or were given, actually, healthy options such as apple slices, carrot sticks, and sandwiches, hummus, etc. They were also were given water instead of, the punch. And so, for drinking. The other group, the party food group, and that's on your right, the last column, they were given the usual treats in the British culture, candy, well, also, as we know in the Western world, potato chips, soda, and as they say in the UK, sweet crisps and fizzy pops. So they were given all of these treats to them. They also were given lots of punch with artificial coloring, sugar, and sodas. At the end of that, about 3 to 4 hours of this party, scientists did the following measures: mean behavior, physical aggression, hyperactive behaviors. So notice the differences. I hope you can see here. 0 incidents in the healthy foods group versus 69 incidents for mean behavior and the party food group. Okay, then also when they measure physical aggression, the healthy food group had only 8 incidents versus 63 incidents in the party food group. That's a huge difference right there, don't you think? The more dramatic figure was shown in the hyperactive behaviors. Only 30 incidents for the healthy food group versus 163 incidents in the party food group. Overall, the total incidence of bad behavior, a ratio of 7 to 1, in the party food groups versus the healthy food group. So let me ask you, do you think the types of food affect our mood and behavior? Definitely they do, and this research showed it clearly in children. Now, an important topic that we must bring this afternoon is learn to trust that eating adequately is good for our health. Let me repeat that. Learn to trust that eating adequately is good for our health. So we don't need to be antsy about foods that we consume, about the amounts that we consume, because we can get into this disruptive circle for our health, our brain health. Emotional overeating, in green, then goes, it can generate us to feel bad because we overate. And then that will lead to more overeating because after that you feel exhausted to be ruminating on these thoughts and you get hungry. And then you get the unpleasant feelings and the red arrow and the cycle begins again. So what we have to do is to restore the inhibition control to food, and that would heal the brain towards efficiency. This disinhibition effect will be avoided or nullified by our choices. So, fasting, and this is what I'm talking about here is intermittent fasting. not, you know, if you can fast, it's been recommended that fasting, that's good. And so it bolsters brain power and function when we give our gut a break. How often? I would say weekly. Diminish your food intake weekly. There's some recommendations, good recommendations out there. In fact, some cultures do this on a regular basis. Why is that? Well, one of the reasons is because it shifts biological priorities. And this is generally in our organisms. It promotes the release of BDNF, which by now we should be familiar with what BDNF is, right? It's, you can only say it is for the neurons. Is what? Fuel for the neurons. Is that neurotrophic factors which we need. What else? Elicits mental acuity. It also promotes a spiritual growth when we fast intermittently, more or less once a week. This was actually discussed by Mark Mattson at Johns Hopkins University extensively. So, continuing now, I like you to really think about what we can do to regulate our food intake, caloric intake thus far.
If this image doesn't make you hungry, then you probably aren't designed to eat meat. We have to, do we survive, or do we eat to survive, or do we survive from what we eat? Are we supposed to trust and to love one another? Does that include animals? What kind of got me on this topic was I've been talking to my patients a lot for the last 7-8 months about changing to a plant-based diet. And some of my patients, my teenage patients and young adults, they were telling me, oh yeah, vegan things are very big on social media, very big online. So I started looking on YouTube channels, looking for veganism and things like that, so that I could talk to my patients about that because they're very engaged with that, and looking for maybe channels I could recommend. So I kind of got, you know, more familiar with their thoughts by doing that. And, you know, sometimes we kind of make fun, and I've been guilty of that in the past, make fun of people who are marching for animal rights and things like that. But, you know, I didn't realize until I read it that actually Ellen White talks about the mistreatment of animals. And that's why I got this idea to write the script for this video that we're going to watch. But just to set the stage for that, God spoke, "Let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature, so they can be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the cattle, and yes, earth itself, and every animal that moves on the face of the earth." This is Genesis 1:26. And then compare that to another philosopher's statement, "Animals do not have will, neither bad or good, so they do not have any intrinsic value. Animals are not self-conscious, and there were merely means to an end. They are merely means to an end. The end is man. Our duties towards animals are merely indirect duties towards humanity." So do we justify our treatment of animals? And when I say our treatment of animals, it includes the money that we pay to industries that mistreat animals. Honestly, a friend of ours actually made this video for us, and I wrote the script, but it's taken from clips online that does show the mistreatment of animals. So you if you don't want to watch it, I'm just warning you about that.
Yeah, before we show it, this video shows very graphic scenes of mistreatment of animals, and these are done in the meat and dairy industry. So if you're susceptible to this type of imagery, you can perhaps get up and leave and take a breather for now, but if you want to stay, you are welcome to do so. But we wanted to put this disclaimer so you're not shocked with the images that we have that appear in this video. All right.
Oops, what happened?
Before we start, notice that in the background you're going to hear a very well-known children's song that talks about how God cares for the little ones. And those are, can include animals as well.
Now you lost it.
God sees a little sparrow fall, it meets his tender view. If God so loves a little birds, I know he loves me too. He loves me too, he loves me too, I know he loves me too. Because he loves the little things, I know he loves me too.
Did you know that each year in the egg industry, 100 million male baby chicks are ground alive so that you can eat eggs? It does not matter where you obtain the eggs, whether the grocery store or from the farm. When supplying both venues, male baby chicks in the egg industry have no purpose and are killed after being born as an inconvenient byproduct of the egg industry. Their bodies are not used for any purpose, and their short existence is lived in great distress. Thus, if we buy eggs or products made with eggs, we are supporting this cruelty. Did you know that Ellen White wrote against animal cruelty? Animals are often transported long distances and subject to great suffering in reaching the market. They are taken from green pastures. Now, many animals eat and never see green pastures. Even so-called free-range chickens often never see green pastures. And traveling for weary miles over the hot, dusty roads or crowded into filthy cars, feverish and exhausted, often for many days, deprived of food and water, the poor creatures are driven to their death so that human beings can feast on the carcasses. Think of the cruelty to the animals that meat eating involves and its effects on those who inflict and those who behold it. How it destroys the tenderness with which we should regard these creatures of God. The intelligence displayed by animals approaches so closely to human intelligence that it is a mystery. The animals see and hear and love and fear and suffer. She ends the chapter with an admonishment to teach the children to practice mercy towards creatures that God has made and placed under our dominion. Did not God make the baby chicken as it hatches? Will God hold you guiltless for supporting with your money the industry's cruel practices now that you know? How can you teach your children to love animals when the products of cruelty to animals are on your table? Recently, a woman was arrested who gave a drink of water to a thirsty pig on the way to slaughter. The charges were later dismissed, but the idea that giving a drink of water to a thirsty animal could be a crime shows the disregard of standards society has for animals. Mother cows in the dairy industry have their babies taken from them. The baby cow will not ever taste his mother's milk. The animals see, feel, love, and suffer. Mother cows are given hormones so that they can produce an unnatural amount of milk. Often her udders become infected with the trauma of milking frequently with the machines. The tissue injury leads to a recurrent infection riddled with pus, and a certain amount of this cellular decaying product is allowed to be in the milk. Cows are impregnated using what the industry calls rape racks. The mother cows are impregnated so often and induced to give so much milk that their natural lifespan is reduced from 20 years to 5 years. The animals see, feel, love, and suffer. In Ellen White's biography book 4, chapter 18, it is written that while in Australia, she bought a cow. She was shocked by the practice of putting the cow's head in a bale and tying up the leg while milking. She declared she would train the cow to stand still while milking, and that she would let the calf run free in the field with its mother for the first 3 years of life. She called the Australian practice barbarous. What would she think of today's practices that we support when we buy any products that are made with milk or cheese? What does God think? Unlike in Ellen's day, we have access to all manner of nutritious food year-round and do not need to use animal products to meet nutritional needs. We do not need to support with dollars the food industry that tortures, rapes, and murders animals.
God sees the little sparrow, all it needs is tender view.
Come on, it's your turn. Learn to love by practicing deep compassion for all God's creatures. It will activate the regions of the brain that exert control over strong emotions and improve total health. We should say that loving animals means loving all animals, not just the ones we don't dare to eat. So this message, I know this message has touched many of us, but this is the reality that 51% Seventh-day Adventists are still eating meat. Should think about. Now, we're not here to convince anybody. We're here to present what's out there, the evidence. Then this images cause you a little bit of a stress, if not a great distress, for the animals. I know that our mirror neurons were firing because we were seeing the suffering these animals were going through, and we were suffering with them. That perhaps is the beginning of this transformation in our brains and our hearts for a better diet. Now, this includes a very, very important principle that we must take into consideration when we think about foods in terms of our spiritual being. To trust and to love cannot be learned in fear. We cannot learn compassion, or we cannot learn the principles of God for His love, His concern for His creation, and fear. That actually does not happen. Thoughts about God can turn on and off the fear circuit of the brain. Now I'm going to take you by the hand to how we think of our God, the God we serve. Is it a God that, that body of principles, the ideas about a God, the God we serve, do they activate our brain circuitry that deals with fear, or that prepares for fear, to withstand fear, or those are conducive to heal our brains away from fear? That should be the question we should ask. Now, this is a review. Remember this graph from day one. This is the fear circuit of the brain with the amygdala, the hypothalamus, the prefrontal cortex, which regulates the effects of the amygdala, which is our alarm, warns us about impending dangers, and the hippocampus, the hypothalamus that regulates this message into the administrator, which is the prefrontal cortex, and the hippocampus that forms memories of this fear. All these areas, including the first responder, the adrenal glands, are involved in this. Do you know, or did you know, rather, that the idea of a spiritual God can actually turn on some of this activity of the fear circuitry in the brain? We'll talk about this, what we know, what the evidence has shown, and what is written also in the Bible is the following. Nurture, trust, and love calm the fear circuit, but lies and abuse disrupts this circuitry, increasing fear, inflammation, and depression. Do you believe in this? So fear is the basis of death. Fear shifts biological properties to survival, muscle away from food absorption. That is the gut. So it mobilizes our fuel resources to the muscles so they can react. They can either fight or flight away from food absorption for our nurturance. They stunt intellectual growth by diminishing the capacity to learn and to remember. Fear predisposes an individual to anticipate rejection and abandonment and thereby stays isolated to the point of total abandonment. Self-awareness goes down and he or she doesn't care anymore in this state. Fear also prevents spiritual growth by stagnating our understanding of how God operates with his creation and in our personal lives, to the point that we do not understand God anymore because the fear circuit is firing constantly and our brains get inflamed and inflamed and inflamed. So that really takes us away from our Creator and who and the God that we should get to know every day. It takes us away from those ideas and we encase in our own little circle and stay there. The fear response is constant in our lives. Here's a quote from the book Cosmic Conflict Over God's Character. The infection of Satan's kingdom, me first, that is selfishness. Survival of the fittest mentality, fear, blame, and selfishness are woven into the very fabric of our fallen human nature. We tend to be that way. We tend to withstand, but God has given us the way out, the solution. It is within our brains. And that's what I tried to bring, my wife and I tried to bring this message of get to know your brain and the capacity of your brain to really heal you in prayer, because the machinery is already there. Everything is there in our brains. Think of this, for example. Think of this. This is a snake out in the wild in its habitat. Would you get scared by it if you walk by it? Would you be terrified? Even more if it's a venomous animal, right? So our brain circuitry would be activated, but we have a prefrontal cortex that would tell us, okay, you are going to be the smarter and the big person here. So what do we do? Do we attack it? Usually we stand still, turn around, and jump and go away, right? I mean, at least I hope you do that, unless we're skilled at killing the animal. But those are the mechanisms that are put in place to flee away from predators like this venomous snake, if it's a venomous one. Otherwise, what happens if you go to a museum or a zoo? Let's say that, a zoo. And in the zoo, you see the same animal enclosed in this environment where it's so safe that you even approach it and try to look at it like you haven't seen it before. Isn't your curiosity aroused? You want to know more about that animal. Why is that? Our brains tell us that the context in which this animal is found is important. But that is precisely what our brain does every time we face challenges that affect us and affect our fear circuit. Our brain must reason whether it is necessary for us to worry, necessary for us to stress, to react, to overreact. Those mechanisms are put in our brains and God has given those to us. Do you want to make use of those mechanisms? Well, it's possible if we keep maintain our brains healthy. Wouldn't you agree? That is possible. I want to share some thoughts because misplaced fear can be influenced by our beliefs. And slowly, my wife and I have been shifting to this thought because we wanted to bring this and enclose it with this spiritual component, because what we believe, the beliefs we held, influence this fear circuitry in our brain. I'm going to read you a couple of quotes here. The first record of fear in man is recorded in the Bible in Genesis 3:10. And it says, it reads, I heard you in the garden. I was afraid and hid from you. This fear response in men occurred after Adam and Eve had misplaced their trust in the living serpent. They now saw God instead of Satan as the one whom they should be afraid. When God called out the men, to the men, where are you? Imagine that. They had shifted the fear that it should be upon who? The deceiver Satan on who? On God their creator. That's what sin does, right? It causes us to not think and not really. They were familiar with God's voice, but this time it sounded different somehow. And that is the first recorded event in which, in the Bible and in history, that we know of a man feeling fear for his creator. Now, another quote here. Yes, and Eve, both of you right. Fear of God has been the basic underlying theme of human history. Now, thousands of years later, Satan's lies about God is still having an almost hypnotizing effect on the human race. Fear of God as punishing tyrant had led many to atheism, while others serve him from fear. There's even a name for fear of God, theophobia. Is this your reality? I hope not. But many out there are struggling with an image of God as a tyrant. And then they said, you know what? God scares me. He scares me, so I'd rather stay away from him. What we believe can come or arouse our brains. So we have it all there.
Negative words and concepts increase the activity in the amygdala, the fear center in the brain, what we've been talking about, cause it to be hyperactive, causing us to produce stress hormones, and angry words send alarm signals, turn on the fear circuits in the brain. And this does what to neuroplasticity? Decreases neuroplasticity, and we want neuroplasticity, right? We want our brains to be healthy. Words, thoughts, these have power to influence the expression of genes that regulate physical emotions, physical and emotional stress. When we use positive words like love and peace, kindness, we can modify the brain's function and increase cognitive reasoning through strengthening the brain. This was an experiment, a research experiment, showing the power of beliefs. So what they did in this experiment is they had two groups of patients. Both of them had their wisdom teeth removed. But one group, they had a mock treatment. So they were told that they were going to get a treatment that would reduce their swelling, some kind of ultrasound treatment that was going to reduce swelling and make their pain better. And they received some kind of fake treatment, but it was not real. But they believed it was real, so they didn't know that. It's called placebo. And what happened? So they got 35% less swelling in the mock treatment group than in the group that didn't have any treatment to reduce swelling. So just in our minds and our beliefs, it changes our physiology and reduces the immune system response, which is pretty amazing, the power of your beliefs. When God built his universe, it was constructed to operate in harmony with his own nature of love and trust. So these are things that affect the health of the mind. Lies break trust. Fear and selfishness lead you to try to survive no matter what. That's the turn on of the fear circuit in the brain towards survival. And destructive acts, sin, damage the mind, body, and character. So this is the power of our beliefs. So what can we do to restore trust and love, volunteer, serve others? This is another study that shows that youth who volunteer have higher academic achievement, better life skills, greater self-confidence, and more civic responsibility. Adults who volunteer tend to live longer, for example, have less illness, suffer less from depression, and less incidence of dementia. There is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. Sorry. Also, they're more independent living. How can we restore love and trust? We can form healthy habits. This is from the Bible, Isaiah 1:18. Be original in your thoughts. Don't follow the crowd. Be responsible. Believe and trust. Develop faith based on evidence. Avoid feelings to form ideas. So, yeah. Believe and ask God to increase our experience and understanding of God's love. And this is from Peter's Counsel to Parents. And 2 Peter 1, the whole chapter, it's constantly urged that young people follow that advice to be faithful and learn. But many rebel. Why is that? Because without a positive concept of God and what he wishes to do for them, children relate to their church and to God out of fear or sheer duty rather than admiration. Religion becomes oppressive, and it's eventually rejected. The emphasis on obedience and growth should be based upon knowing God as a friend. And so that's that.
Can we trust a friend who will kill us if we don't love him? That is a question that some have asked after covering this truth, this quote. We want to finish by telling you that everything we have shared with you throughout this week and these seminars have three components. We have not just picked this data, these findings, these things, these recommendations we've made to you from one source, but from three: from science, spiritual insight, and experience. All three have influenced our thought, made us make all this content into a harmonized truth. Science, because without science and spiritual insight, there is mysticism. Without experience, there can be any belief and maybe lack of empathy for others. And without spirituality, we can basically come up with our own reasoning and be gravely mistaken. Science is the observant of principles and harmonious natural laws, so that, for instance, we know that gravity exists. That is actually a natural law, right? Would you agree? So what would happen if we get up in that pole behind us, in that course, and decide that we should jump just to try what happens? We'll be breaking the law of gravity, and boy, the consequences can be grave. God forbid, we'll end up in the ground dead. But that is not a punishment. That is simply a consequence of our actions, wouldn't you agree? Because a natural law was broken. So the consequence of the breaking of that law, natural law, lead to death, or put up, or stop breathing. Let's say we're not going to take oxygen for about 5 minutes. See what happens. So all these things put in there by God, created for us, for a reason, for a purpose, to sustain life, if tested to prove him wrong, may lead us to death, because that is the wage of breaking that natural law. So these are everlasting principles that God has put in for a harmonious universe. If we think of a God in that sense, we can better understand him and why things do and don't happen in our lives while we're on earth. Wouldn't you agree? So that is what the science gives us. The spiritual insight allows us to have moral altruistic principles or be under those principles. So our dependence is not upon ourselves, but on a higher force. So when we've been talking to you about these truths, these things, and excited about the science, we have also thought about the compassion that we feel for everyone. And so every time we pray to God and say, Lord, we are learning. We don't know it all. But we want you to give us the passion to help those who don't know, who know less than us. Because that motivation really reflects what God wants. He wants all to come to salvation. Isn't that right? So that's the spiritual insight. By knowing him, we become better equipped to transmit these messages of health. And experience. Without experience, we'll be lacking greatly. We'll be simply lecturing and lecturing and lecturing. But we actually went through this, my wife and I, both of us experienced. I had, like you, brother, some allergic reactions. And I studied the immune system. I'm a neuroimmunologist by training during my graduate school years at the School of Medicine Loma Linda. And there we studied these interactions between the brain and the immune system. But what happens? Sometimes the appetite is the one that wins over. So we don't pay attention to those things until, thanks to my loving wife and what she read, she shared with me, and I went to the literature and I go, you know what, there's something to this. And then I started to do my own studies upon myself, testing what foods and teasing out, and lo and behold, I found the benefits of lowering and not eating eggs anymore, which you'd be surprised, and this is a confession of mine. This year is when I stopped eating eggs. And so now I'm vibrant and happy. I don't have the allergy responses I used to have. And I can enjoy these heels right here. As a matter of fact, my wife and I would like to take a stroll here. We'd like to go out walking and explore a little bit of what's around us. This beauty that surrounds us right now, right here in this place. So this experience has made us more empathic, to empathize with those that have challenges when it comes to health, diet, spirituality. So you see these three, I hope, and I really, I'm going to ask my wife to come up here. So we really ask you that you really take this three-prong approach at everything you do. At everything you do. Take it with a passion, because this approach is really will bring the harmonized truth at its best. We want to finish by sharing two quotes. One is this one from Selected Messages, one page 338, and it reads, "By beholding, we become changed, and as we meditate upon the divine model, we shall desire to become holy, transformed, and renewed in the image of his purity. It is by faith, which is trust, in the Son of God, that transformation takes place in the character of the child of wrath, which is fear. And it becomes the child of God." So this was written long ago. But this verse is the one that sums it all. 2 Corinthians 3:18 from the standard, I think it's the English Standard Version. Yes, it is. "And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image, from one degree of glory to another. For what comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." I apologize for that typo there. But you see, we are supposed to keep growing, right? We're not supposed to gain the knowledge, just stay there, and not keep learning. So we invite you to do this and apply it to your own lives. And we hope that we have shared this knowledge about the secrets of brain health, that you go out of here and share this with other people. We have this green book, and I'm going to Just grab it. If you have not signed, you are welcome to do so at the end of our talk after the questions section. Come on out and add your name here. These are all the individuals that won materials, and we'll send them to you, actually from our talks. We also have some literature. We have Ministry of Healing that the Godfreys have provided very kindly. We also have some magazines. And if you don't have anything else to add, hon, I think we will open the floor for some from questions from you. Okay, we have a lady here that would like to ask a question.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming. This has been wonderful. Thank you very much. And I thought of some things while you were talking that have helped me, and I pray that they will help others that are here. I have four children, and when they were little, I raised them vegetarian but not vegan. But I never gave them Kool-Aid or Hawaiian punch or anything. And we went to this wedding reception, and they had this fountain with this juice coming out of it. And my kids said, oh, cool, please, can we have some? We never had that. And they drank the juice, quite a bit of it, and they became so hyper, I said, these can't be my children. They never acted like that before. And you know, it took the next day for that to get out of their system. So that coloring and sugar. And then when I was 17, I became an Adventist. And I read the book, Counsels on Diet and Foods. And I remember, and I saw in there, one of the things she said, you're talking about eating, overeating, and not one morsel of food should pass between our lips between meals. And I know you know this quote. And I used to eat between meals, and I found that I was hungry then at mealtime. And since then, I have never eaten between meals again. I never snack, never eat anything between meals. And then I used to have a problem with overeating, believe it or not. And I prayed and prayed, and God, that little voice said, more or less that little voice would say, you've had enough. And if I didn't listen, then I would overeat. And then a friend of ours told me that his wife used to have a problem with overeating, and she stopped taking seconds. And I never take seconds, and I find that that really had helped me and has helped me. Because I figure in 4 hours, 5 hours, I'm going to eat again. I'm not going to starve to death, so I never take seconds. And then there's one more thing that I just learned about turmeric. You're familiar with turmeric, curcumin, and that it really helps inflammation. So I put it in my green smoothie, and that way I get my greens. I like Swiss chard. In the morning, with fresh pineapple and turmeric, a spoonful of turmeric, and I don't have any aches, hurts when I get out of bed in the morning. I don't hurt anywhere, and I'm really attributed a lot to the turmeric. And then I thought, well, I'm going to Google it and see what else it's good for. And then on the website, it said that in India, you know, they put turmeric in everything, curry and everything. And there's a very low instance of dementia in India.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really something I should share. And I just hope it helps what I've
Thank
said.
You.
Helps people.
Of course
Thank
it
you.
Does. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes.
You know, adding to that, Dr. Gomez Pinilla, which wrote a talked about it, and I met him personally at UCLA. This gentleman right here, the one that elucidated this mechanism, well, he actually did a lot of research. He's the one that studied turmeric and was telling me, hey, do you know about this? I'd like to test it. And that was in 2010.
Yeah.
2010.
Yeah.
Actually.
He came to Loma Linda and spoke. Yeah.
We brought him over to Loma Linda.
We kind of had an influence in bringing him to Loma Linda to speak. He wasn't the best speaker, but he's done a lot of good research.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And in my smoothie, then, of course, it tastes great.
Yeah.
So I get it every morning, and
So remember, turmeric is good for the brain, yes, and inflammatory.
Yeah.
I missed something. I have number one, learn to manage stress. Number two, exercise regularly. Number three, rest well. And I'm missing something. What was four?
On the, you mean on our beginning page,
yes,
this
right
one?
There.
Rest well, eat for today and the future, learn to trust and love.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, this is how we summarize basically the steps, but you can reward them in any way you want, basically.
Sam, I got a general question for you. You guys have influence as doctors. We just watched the horror of that animal issue. I know that the industry is so powerful with money, but can the professionals do something about getting more of that out generally to the American public? It seems to me like a conspiracy to destroy people as opposed to help people.
Yes, it is a conspiracy because industries are trying to make money. And the animal industry is probably the most powerful, most moneyed industries in the U.S.
Yes. We, right, as Rhoda said, they're very powerful. And basically, the disregard for animals have hit a new high. Let's put it that way. There are reasonings out there that they say, well, would you rather hinder the population from the protein source to the point that every time I go to the store, and I told Rhoda this, they don't call meat meat. What kind of meat? They call it what? Anybody knows? I heard it, protein. Straight out protein. You know what I say? No, I'll go with the vegetable proteins, please. And they look at me twice, like, did I get this right? I said, no, they want the vegetable protein, not the meat protein. Ah, okay, sure, sir. Yeah, sure. Why not? And this is a good stores that are called health conscience, but they call meat protein. They don't call it meat, an animal, you know, from a carcass of an actual animal. They're just a source of protein. And protein is a nutrient. So not only has come from a food item, it has, and now it's named as an actual nutrient. So that's the reality we live in.
Yeah, and actually, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, in his book Whole, he talks about this problem. And also, Dr. Neil Bernard talks about this problem. So there's voices talking about these problems and really bringing up the idea that it's hurting people. It's really murder. To not give people information. It's very similar to the tobacco industry and what they did in the 50s and the 60s to try to cover up the research that showed that tobacco was bad for you. So it's very similar to that. They're trying to put out research now that is it's funded by the food industry, and they have ways to manipulate it so that it looks ambiguous as to the health consequences. But the health consequences are very clear, so they have an open space to put out research because the government's not really funding research in cholesterol anymore because it's so clear that cholesterol is bad for your health. They're not really funding it anymore. So then the industry comes in and funds other studies and makes things look muddy.
Right.
But
a couple of things. Curcumin within the turmeric, it also prevents Alzheimer's and cancer, and it kills the pain tremendously for arthritis. There's so many studies done on this. It's just all around. It's a wonderful supplement to take on a regular basis for what it does and prevents and heals. Mm-hmm. And the pharmaceutical industry is a multi-billion dollar industry that they're right in cahoots with the companies that kill the animals, and they drug them. They give them so many hormones. If it's not a naturally, organically raised, whatever, it's crazy what's going on. It goes into our bodies and we get the cancer.
So 80%, I think, is the number of antibiotics are actually used in the animal food industry in the United States. So antibiotics are keeping these animals alive in unhealthy conditions. And that's just a reality. And yes, there are, the pharmaceutical companies are also very powerful, and they like nothing better than you to go to McDonald's and then run over to your doctor and get your prescription for your Lipitor. So
right.
That we have McDonald's right outside the hospital or the outpatient office that I work at. So unfortunately, a lot of my patients are either coming from McDonald's or going to McDonald's as they leave. So, okay.
I mean, I don't know everything or expect to know, and there's a lot more I need to know and stuff. And I think what I've heard tonight and stuff really kind of made me think over some things. I'm kind of new in the Venice Church, and I'm learning. And but I will, from what I was thinking here is that there's an attitude out in this world today that, well, they would hear a message like you're bringing forth right now, okay? And they would say, you know, well, I'm going to go, you know, I'm used to my old way. You know, I'm not going to change.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, that's the attitude of a lot of people, which I understand it because, I'm sure I got feelings that. But I was thinking while I was sitting here and thinking that people having attitudes like that, that, well, I was thinking, well, what would be pleasing in God's eye and what would be best for me in my life? And then I start thinking, well, maybe that's something I should look into. And, you know, if there is something there about what you was mentioning, and I'm sure there is to, and stuff. And like I said, if you're not learning to know these things, but to go on and to find out and to pray about these things.
Yes.
Pray and ask God for his help. Lord, for something about this, show me. Open my eyes to it, you know? I mean, that's a start. That's
Amen.
What I'm thinking. You know, that's a start.
Yes.
So
yes.
I just had to hear that.
That
just came to me, and I just thought I'd share it.
Thank you.
Thank you
for sharing that. I mean, that's really the reason why we're doing these seminars is to let people know, to let them know the information so that you can make a decision
right. Based
on real information. So I appreciate you sharing
that. Thank you for sharing it. I appreciate that.
We come in contact with a lot of people and their meat eaters, and they just can't get over the idea that you can get enough protein without eating meat. Is there like a simple resource that I could direct them to, like a YouTube video or,
because they're
usually sitting in our laundry, you know, on their media devices? Something really simple and catching that could grab their attention.
There are actually, that's a good question. I have been watching, like I say, YouTube channels, and there are quite a few that are kind of geared toward veganism. And some of them would kind of be for some people, and others might be for others. There's Happy Healthy Vegan is a good one. They do a lot of different stuff. These are not Adventist. I don't really know of any Adventist YouTube channels that promote this that are popular. Guilt-Free TV is another one. He does a lot of like fitness stuff, and he does a lot of recipes. And he has two kids, so those two children and his wife all eat the plant-based, and he tends to be oil-free. That Vegan Couple is another one. They have recipes and things. They're kind of more in the animal rights when they talk. They talk a lot about the cruelty to animals. So it kind of depends on what the person's more interested in as far as what's going to appeal to them. So there are a lot of different people trying to spread the message of veganism. Can you think of some other ones?
We're going to send you, we got your names here, And there's a lot of web links. So we'll send those to you,
so,
resources.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to try to set up a Facebook group so that we can send you a link for that. So when we get things, we can post them to the Facebook group and then kind of share information that way. So, yeah.
I have a question. I have a question about detoxins. I know there's certain berries and fruits and stuff and stuff that detox your body.
Yes.
But I want to know if you all know anything about chaga.
Chocolate?
C-H-A-G-A. Chaga. They call it a mushroom, but it's not. It's chaga mushroom. It grows on a birch tree. You make tea out of it. It's a detoxin.
No, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't. I would have to look that up.
Yeah, thank you. You know what? I've come in here. Another couple, I don't see them here, told me about a shrub that is high. They claim it's high in omega-3s. So I wrote the name, and I'm going to investigate it. And
so write down chaga.
And so I heard about that, by the way.
Chaga has more... Choga, or however you pronounce it, it comes from over there in Russia, Siberian places, or any place that's high in altitude, where birch trees grow, and it's supposed to be the highest detoxin on the planet. Choga in Russian means gift from God, and
yes, I remember now. It's been a while. We haven't thought about that choga, but I have heard about that one.
I drink it on a daily basis, and I'm testimony to what it can do for you. I got bad rotary cups. I had one worked on, but not the other, and I couldn't sleep for the pain in my shoulders and arms, and I got rheumatoid arthritis real bad, and my doctor, you know, of course, has been treating it with chemicals. You know, what the chaga does, when you make a tea out of it, the number one thing it takes care of is inflammation. Mm-hmm. And I drank two cups of it on a Friday and went out Sabbath morning, and that was the best sleep I got for months. And as long as you drink the chaga, I haven't ached or hurt since. And one of our pastors, Don Jacko, at our church, when he gives the nutrition reports and stuff, he drinks it. And he recommends anybody that's wanting to detox their body, it's the number one thing to detox your body with, you know. But you'll have to research it to find out what the properties and everything of it is, but you'll find it'll be amazing when
Absolutely.
You read it.
Absolutely. We shall do that. Thank you for sharing that. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Now, all this information, definitely we'll look it up.